with Esther Rotz, who is the director and writer of Can Go Through Skin, as well as Dan Gessen, a special last-minute guest who will probably be appearing at some point during the course of this conversation. But I wanted to say, Esther, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm enjoying New York very much. So.
Very, very good. So let's talk about the title, Can Go Through Skin, and why skin is so important for your main character, Mareki. Mareki burns herself in the bathtub water late in the film. She is forced to run through the streets naked to escape this assault. Her skin likewise expands with one particular development, which I won't reveal, late in the film. And it's as if her skin, who is meant to be exposed, scalded, stretched, and otherwise manipulated throughout the course of the movie. So if her skin almost exists to prevent a wild and highly idiosyncratic soul from essentially bursting out of her flesh, I'm wondering if this movie is really a matter of someone who is experiencing a trauma who can't be comfortable in her own particular skin, and why there must exist the danger that if her soul bursts out through her skin, maybe we could talk about this. I know I threw a lot at you, but I think your film does have this very conscious skin metaphor. So.
Skin, as you are saying, represents quite a lot of different aspects that I'm very interested in. The one of the most important ones to me is the fragility of it. It's protecting you. It's keeping your private insights, your private ideas, and emotions. And nobody can see it from the outside, or sometimes they can, or sometimes they see something different. And it's the fragility of it. I mean, you can so easily put a knife through. It's nothing. Skin is nothing. And it's also so protecting you and your thoughts.
Well, I also want to talk about this notion of privacy. I'm wondering if there were any specific decisions you made of certain private thoughts and feelings that Mareki would not express through the film. For example, I cite the vocation. I only learned through the press notes that she actually worked an IT job. It wasn't quite evident with the way that she used the computer that this was actually in relation to some kind of work, because she plays Donkey Kong and she does this chat form and the like. So why keep certain thoughts and feelings away from the audience when in fact you have many rather idiosyncratic and odd thoughts and very explicit allusions in this particular movie? What was the criteria for the decision making?
What I always am very interested in more is what the viewer makes out of a few hints themselves.
Yeah.
The story the viewer makes from a loose. Hints is much more stronger because they make it in relation to their own life and to their own, and therefore it's very acceptable for them. It's reality. The story the viewer makes is always much more potent than the story the maker gives them. So the less you really tell them, the more strong the story becomes for them.
But the interesting thing about this dilemma about her work is that by not knowing her work, you're essentially saying, well, this movie is not really about her work. It's about this lonely psyche outside of work in which she struggles to go ahead and find a way to keep on going. And so I'm wondering if it's your suggestion that this film is a way of exposing solitude or even one's societal role outside of work and what one's life is, that this was a particular conscious emphasis for you in concocting this film.
I'm sorry, I have no...
Okay, that's... because we do not know her work.
Yeah.
Therefore, the film is very much about what her role is outside of work, and how she deals with her lonely soul outside of work. So I'm wondering, in deciding against showing certain aspects of her life in this film, you are deliberately focusing in on this part of how we exist in the world that is not normally focused upon, meaning living outside of work, loneliness outside of work, and the like.
You said about how we exist in the world, and that is largely intuitive.
Yeah.
And you also asked what was the criteria for decision making in this film, and that is also intuitive.
Intuitive. So to what degree does it become not intuitive? To what degree do you plan it, and to what degree is it intuitive?
Oh, it's 100% intuitive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I only started analyzing now.
Uh-huh.
When the whole film was color corrected and on celluloid, and up until that moment the whole editing has been done purely on gut feeling. And and what I think now is that the most important thing about the, how do you say, perspective of this film is 100% Marika. If for her things aren't interesting, then it's not in the film. She doesn't think about it. So she knows what her job is, and she knows at that moment she is not interested or captured by any thoughts about her job. So we don't get that so much.
You also have to remember that that because Esther is the writer, the director, and the editor of this film, that that intuitive process in terms of deciphering who Marika is present at every stage of making the film. The writing, the directing, and the editing all have intuition as a very relevant aspect.
But at the same time, there are very explicit decisions to have Marika exist in Squalor, for example, and to take a shower and have this rat running around. There's a specific decision made when you take her out of the city and put her into the particular country, where it becomes this scenario in which she must find her identity through location or through renovation. So on some level, there must be this notion of reconstruction. There must be this notion of even going beyond intuition, or knowing that there is perhaps a theme in place with which one can find further intuitions, you know?
Making decisions, you can make decisions on gut. Of course, there have been made strong decisions, and something is good or something isn't, and that's a decision. But
intuition was just about the process. Let's not get confused. The decision for the countryside and the city, that's a very explicit written scenario.
It's like life.
Yeah.
It's like things happen and God knows why, and the only thing you can do is deal with them or ignore them, or that's...
Okay. To what degree did the story or the scenario switch during the course of filmmaking, and how difficult was this for the actors? Because if they have a very fixed idea of what they're supposed to do and suddenly it becomes perhaps a 180, then this becomes a difficult task for them to adapt to something that they have prepared for.
Yeah. Yeah, I had the immense luck to work with a hugely talented woman who was just as interested in portraying Marika as honestly as she could as me. So the search we both were into was about, okay, this is happening, and how do you deal with that? The interesting thing about how I worked with Rivka was we didn't rehearse a lot. We just talked about how Marika was before all of this happened, because that's the only thing Marika knows. She only knows how she was as a person, and that's what she's trying to find again during the film. She wants to go back to the person she was without realizing that person is gone. So the person she is after the main attack is a new person, and she has to find herself again, get to know herself again. And so the every step we took as a crew, as a filmmaker team, was how do we deal with such a big blow?
Yeah, yeah.
On a daily basis.
Well, there's also this notion, this very interesting qualities about Marika, where she drinks wine in one gulp, almost as if it's water. Was this something that you brought to it, or the actress brought to this? How did this come about?
Was it at all? Yeah, maybe it was a sound man.
We were
on the set with five people. It's very, very, very small crew, and therefore you can only do that if you completely trust those people, and anything anybody said was really well thought of, and if it was a good idea, we used it, and if it was a lame idea, we didn't use it. Yeah, but everybody had a.
The idea of the workshop was a very important, I think, in workshopping scenes.
Yeah. Was 5 the absolute minimum number of crew that you could do to have an effective workshop, as also keep a film going and made and produced in this manner? That this was really the bare minimum required. Yeah. I mean, did you have 10 initially, and then you whacked it down to 5, or what?
Oh yeah, it grew on certain days. Certain days we had stuntmen, so we had big days, as we call them, and small days. And small days was us 5 on the set, which was the sound man. The cameraman and his assistant, and then Rivka and me, and we did everything. If a wall needed to be painted, we had a half an hour break and we painted the wall. And
oh,
then,
really? Yeah. Did you often decide to paint a wall just on instinct here?
Absolutely on instinct.
Really, like the blue wall matching the blue shirt, something like that.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, that looks good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you do any painting during the course?
Actually, that blue wall was done by me.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and it was painted on top of asbestos, so nobody else wanted to do it, so it was just me and the paintbrush.
So let's establish who these 5 people were. It's obviously you, an actor or a number of actors, the sound man, the cameraman, and who else?
The gaffer, who was also the lighting man, he did a lot as well. Everybody, because we were just such a small crew, everybody had to do everything. Yeah. So, and then we had behind the scenes, we had someone to buy bread and take care of all the productional
logistics.
Yeah, made sure we got home to a warm bed.
Yeah,
stuff like that.
Now, were your short films done with a similar 5 crew?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. It's the best way of working.
Really. What did you at any point during the course of perhaps conceiving all of these films, did you consider working with a larger crew, or did this just not appeal to you, or was this just largely logistics that dictated the small crew?
No, it's a small crew has actually two huge advantages. The first one is the level of concentration and trust, and like I just now said, if somebody mentions something, then I've got the tranquility to really listen, and I know they know what we're heading to. And the other one is, I lost the other one.
Well, communication,
but it's huge.
Communication is very important, and to keep the lines as short as possible.
Uh-huh.
And just to blow my own trumpet, I was also present, but I just wasn't on the set.
Uh-huh.
I built temporary sound design studios, or I was in the village,
uh-huh.
But I wasn't with Rivka in the bathtub, as it were.
You were channeling your own particular spirit there.
I was making my own parallel story.
Yeah. Really? Okay. Well, I mean, maybe we could talk about what that particular parallel story was and how this perhaps had to be shifted with the intuitive and ever-shifting nature of this film production, and how this, whether this created any particular problems for you in terms of the sound design.
Well, the intuitive aspect of it was, what was it? It was really about being saturated by the context, and that you can only do by, as Esther said, workshopping scenes on a daily basis, and for me, recording sounds on a daily basis from, and also through the seasons, because for the people that will know about apple trees and pruning, nowadays a lot of it's done with hydraulics, and you get this fantastic percussive sound, which is a sort of fch, fch, fch. Which we didn't use, but the world is full of those kind of percussive sounds in our ambient environment.
Yeah.
And my job as a sound designer, as I see it, is to just collect as much of that context as possible, and then later use it in the sound design in the studio.
Got it. Now, here's a question for both of you. Perhaps you could talk about how the editing affected or altered the sound design, or was the sound design, for the most part, relatively fixed throughout the production process, to what degree was it shifted over in the post-production? Because there's a lot of, for example, jarring disconnects between the visuals and the sounds. Sometimes jump cuts, sometimes heartbeats, and the like, and sometimes rising sounds, decreasing sounds. So how did post-production change the sound design, and how did the intuitive process continue throughout the course of post-production?
Because this film was shot during a whole year, we needed the four seasons. I was still writing in between the recording days and editing at the same time. So everything just went through one another. And as soon as Dan found out a perfect piece of sound, he gave it to me so I could play with it during the editing.
The songs were really were more significant in... Also, in two important points, because we've worked together on Esther's other short films, and we understand and trust each other, and with that experience, a short film is very different to a long film, and the level of saturation which you can have in a short film is very different to that of a long film, and you need the silence in Can Go Through Skin. It needs nothing as well as a lot, and the songs were really you could call it very conventional, but it also takes you out, it creates distance from Marika.
Yeah,
they're more. And those were written as parallel stories, although they fit. And Esther, so I wrote these parallel stories, and Esther would just put them in and see if they worked, and that worked, and then maybe we do another one, and then things were thrown away.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have a parallel story on sound, while there is this other story on film. I'm wondering, to what degree was it necessary for both of you in your respective storytelling to resist traditional narrative? This is obviously something in which an intuitive artistic process creates something that's a little unconventional. And yet at the same time, one might also say, well, you kind of have to have some conventionality in order to get the audience hooked. Or is such a distinction not a distinction for what you both do?
I think you could probably break the film down into a three-act structure if you want to, but I don't think really that's relevant.
I'm totally unaware of any rules or any rhythms a film should apply to. I just start somewhere, and if it doesn't feel good, we stop.
Yeah.
And we change it and
chop it out. There was a lot of things went. I mean, we both have enough material to make two films.
Yeah.
And there's but it's one film, and it's a gesamt Kunstwerk.
Yeah.
It's not the homogeny exists through. Also, and I didn't mention that Esther's also the producer, one of the producers of the film, and that is a very important aspect of logistical decision making.
Yeah.
Priorities.
Yeah.
You know, and having a complete understanding of that. I really should belittle make smaller my parallel stories. Is more to do with it was sort of independent. I was using the same mud, the sounds of the same mud, and the same smells from the rotting house. I had that in my nostrils, as so did Marika, and so did Esther, and this five crew, and that's very relevant. The level of saturation.
Did you actually take the odors home and try to reproduce those odors, or was it largely a sense memory kind of thing?
That's something you just take with you, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of. Influence and how fantastic wet grass can feel or rusty barbed wire and the relevance thereof, and that when you're in that environment and when you're involved at such a level of tactile experience, then it inevitably influences what you see. I think
Okay. Well, this leads me to wonder then how the house was located. Did you, in fact, try to find a house that had the stinkiest possible odor or something that was possibly in disuse? And the rat, how did you wrangle the rat in the course of the shower scene? That could not have been easy to do since it is vermin, you know.
It's a shame this is radio, but if I'm poking out my thumb now and it's got white lines all over it, that was directing the rat.
Really?
Yeah, he nibbled the middle bit of my thumb. It was hanging there for quite some time and biting away. That was me directing a rat. I'm not good at
Did you have to see a doctor get shots to make sure?
Yeah. It was too chewed up.
Tetanus jab.
Yeah, everything. Yeah. So, no, rats are not directable. They just do their own way. But that might be a natural talent as well.
They say that kids and animals are the toughest to direct, but you would say that a rat is even tougher.
Yeah, and boats boats are also a cliche.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Boats?
Boats, kids, and animals. And about the house, we were just incredibly lucky with a very good location scout. He came across many houses that were good, but they all either had a psychopath guy sitting up the attic or
psychopathic guys.
People who live in a house like this are not living under normal circumstances, and there's a reason for that.
Oh, yeah.
And this house was in such a bad shape because there was a lawsuit about it.
Uh-huh.
So that's a quite, how do you say, a sane reason for a house to be like that. So that's why we were very lucky.
You were very specific in your in what you wanted for the house.
Yeah, but
and for the
wanting,
location.
Wanting and getting it are two different things.
Yeah.
So you can dream about it has to be like this, but
What were the specific conditions? And also, this leads me to ask: did you need a house that had been occupied by one of these so-called psychopathic guys, or what?
Most of the conditions were to do about the atmosphere. It had to be a house that could either be beautiful, depending on the day Marieke woke up. Sometimes she loves the house and she sees the possibilities of it and the countryside, the enormous, beautiful countryside. And sometimes it's this... it's so nasty and... it's useless trying to fix it. She is a thing she'll never be able to finish because it's so incredibly rotten. So, and this house had both, very charming and very it's sucking all the
life
out of her. Yeah.
Mm. The cubby hole. I'm curious how this came about. Did it come with the house, or was this something that you found?
Oh no, that was something that was in the script.
Okay.
And was built in. Actually, the kitchen wasn't there.
So really?
The kitchen is it used to be the living room. So that whole thing is done by very talented art directors.
Got it. Well, then, how did the bathtub then get in the kitchen? Because that was interesting.
She just dragged it in. Marieke dragged it in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a plastic. It's used for animals to drink out of, and
okay.
She used it for the bath.
Okay. Now this then leads me to wonder how much of the script is actually in the final film. How much of the material here was fixed, and to what degree? I mean, if we were to go ahead and look at the script, would it have any resemblance aside from say this quality?
It's very interesting because we were very clear about the whole thing. Forget about the script; it's just a a lead.
Yeah.
But now, after finishing the film, it's quite similar to the script. So
is that more about the feeling of the script or because
no, the actual events
the
and
actual
the actual
events,
the thing I was mostly worried about was how the relationship between Marieke and her neighbor would grow, and how she would start to trust him or not. And so I thought there would be major changes to the script whilst the two actors were growing accustomed to one another, but it wasn't. It wasn't necessary.
You didn't actually know the outcome between her and John.
No.
Interesting.
No, yeah,
interesting.
That was a big gamble for all of us. But it stuck to the script quite profoundly.
Well, this is interesting because then when you get into questions of financing, if you go to a financier and say, hey, I've got this script, it may not actually turn out to be the film, but please give me money. How do you get money with a situation like that?
Yeah, I'm very amazed as well. We were very, very, very lucky to find a few really daring people in the Netherlands.
To support the project.
Yeah, and they really jumped in and stuck their necks out and trusted us. And they came by every now and then and just advised us. They never said, they never put their foot down and say, it should be more this. Or we had, well, nearly total freedom. And I'm quite amazed about the Dutch system being able to work like that.
Support such a project.
Yeah, and such a, weird makers.
But you do have a good track record. I mean, you have the first two short films were in Cannes. They're great, intuitive, poetic short films. The third was, that was great as well.
Maybe that
dialogue,
helped.
Dialogue, oofening.
Yeah.
But I mean, when does, say, a financer come during the course of the film, or does the financer essentially leave you alone because of this reputation? Is this how? I mean, can a Dutch filmmaker get away with this in a way that, say, we can't do that in America? Or?
Yeah. Well, this is not normal to be done in the Netherlands either. Yeah. I think that. Yeah. I've heard nasty stories, but yeah. I think also because I really had a good talk with everybody involved before we started, so everybody knew what they were getting themselves into, and they wanted to jump in anyway. So some really good people really believed in it. Very lucky. Yeah.
Well, Esther and Dan, thanks very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Well, thank you too.
Thanks.
My skin is white as parchment, dialed in a downtown office building where the air is tight. This time spent resting on her bones, waiting for the telephones to ring.